Hello, everyone. This is Kevin Amos here on WRCT Pittsburgh, and welcome to our Wednesday edition of Ebony Spectrum. Rick and I are going to dedicate this program to two great individuals that we just lost. One is the Dr. Ralph Proctor, who Rick worked with for many years at Community College of Allegheny County. And for many years, Dr. Proctor was a mentor to me, as well as one of my college professors, who helped me get my credentials in ethnic and diversity studies. The other person is Bob Davis, and a lot of you have heard him on this program before, and he is one of the co-founders of SoulPatrol.com, Soul-Patrol.com. We recently lost Bob the other day to a sudden illness, and he passed away on this past Sunday. So looking at Dr. Proctor and looking at Bob, we have two things that are both related to both of them. One is Lena Horne. Dr. Proctor has written a lot about the Hill District, and you can read about more of the Hill District and his coming up in his latest book. And also, Bob Davis introduced me to Mary Wilson years ago. Mary Wilson, one of the co-founders of the Supremes. I met her on the R&B 40 program when they were taping it here in Pittsburgh, and I got to talk with Mary, a lot off mic, but this program from In Black America is a reflection on both of these folks, as you'll hear John Hansen talk about. So stay with us.
From the University of Texas at Austin, KUT Radio, this is In Black America.
I spoke up for myself and the three musicians, or the six musicians I toured with, that weren't allowed to stay where I could, or we were all not allowed to go in a swimming pool or something. It had nothing to do with anything except personal attitudes about certain things. I didn't realize that I was speaking for anybody else until, oh, way in the late 1940s. And of course, as I said, I was raised by a very militant grandmother. I think most of us have grandmothers in our past. And she just taught me that I was human like everybody else.
Lena Horne, entertainer, pathfinder, and civil rights activist. A smooth singer of bluesy ballads, Horne appeared on stage in Harlem when she was 14 years old. By age 16, she was singing in the famous Cotton Club. Eventually, she made her way into film, including the popular 1943 musical Stormy Weather and Cabin in the Sky. Her performance in Cabin in the Sky is regarded as one of the finest performances of her career. She played Georgia Brown opposite Ethel Waters and Eddie Anderson in the all-black production. Horne's talent, beauty, and middle-class upbringing help her crack the color barrier in Hollywood. She's often remembered as a pioneer among African-American performers. Also, she became a pinup girl to thousands of African-American GIs during World War II. Her active career spanned six decades, and in 1989, she was awarded the Grammy Lifetime Achievement Award. This program was first produced in March 1983. I'm John L. Hansen, Jr., and welcome to another edition of In Black America. On this week's program, a Black History Month special, the legendary Lena Horne in Black America.
Don't know why there's no sun up in the sky, stormy weather, since my man and I together keeps raining all the time. just can't get my poor self together. I'm weary all the time. The time.
I think what you really mean is survival. I've been around a long time. Yeah. Feels good to live this long. I hope that my youngest granddaughter, who's 13, will be less blasé than my other ones, who are 18 and 16. They're not interested in traveling abroad or seeing the sights that I thought I was working toward, taking my children and my grandchildren on a grand tour of Europe and even including Africa now. But one of them was born over in Europe, and two of them from New York have been everywhere over there when they were little, and they're not interested. And I'm praying that the 13-year-old one still is not too blasé to take a trip with me, if I can just hold out that long. I think women shouldn't really be that insecure. I always was. I wanted to have a better figure. I wanted to be beautiful. I wanted to sing like Aretha Franklin, if there had been Aretha when I was born. I had none of those things, and I made it, you know. So I think it's pretty silly of women to want to be like me. They should want to be beyond, and they shouldn't be envious.
Since 1933, when her ambitious stage mother put her into the chorus line of Harlem's famed Cotton Club, Miss Horn has been on stage and in the public eye. Over the years, Lena's had developed the sultry, inimitable Lena Horne singing style for which she is known throughout the world. Lena's first big break as a singer came in 1940 when she was hired by Charlie Barnett, who at that time was the leader of one of the swing era's top big bands. After touring with Charlie Barnett's band, Lena, artistically and psychologically seasoned, struck out on her own, first in Manhattan's famed Cafe Society downtown, and then in Hollywood. There, she was discovered by an MGM talent scout, who promptly signed her to a long-term contract. Her film debut was far from auspicious. Considered too light for black parts and too dark for white parts, she was relegated to musical scenes that had no connection with the plot and consequently could easily be cut from reels earmarked for distribution in the South. She did, however, star in a couple of all-black movies, Stormy Weather in 1943 and Cabin in the Sky, also in 1943. Lena Horne was Hollywood's first bona fide black glamour star, the first black actress not cast in stereotypical maid and mammy roles. To blacks across this nation, this made her a symbol of black achievement and pride. During World War II, she became the pinup of thousands of black GIs, many of whom went into battle in jeeps, tanks, and aircrafts named after her. Considered by many as the most beautiful woman in the world, Lena takes her beauty in stride. I spoke with Lena on tour with her one-woman show and asked her about her status as a living legend.
I haven't been able to answer that question yet, and everybody in each city has asked me. I think what you really mean is survival. I've been around a long time. Yeah, feels good to live this long. I hope that my youngest granddaughter, who's 13, will be less blasé than my other ones, who are 18 and 16. They're not interested in traveling abroad or seeing the sights that I thought I was working toward, taking my children and my grandchildren on a grand tour of Europe and even including Africa now. But one of them was born over in Europe, and two of them from New York have been everywhere over there when they were little, and they're not interested. And I'm praying that the 13-year-old one still is not too blasé to take a trip with me, if I can just hold out that long. I think women shouldn't really be that insecure. I always was. I wanted to have a better figure. I wanted to be beautiful. I wanted to sing like Aretha Franklin, if there had been Aretha when I was born. I had none of those things, and I made it, you know. So I think it's pretty silly of women to want to be like me. They should want to be beyond, and they shouldn't be envious.
In her years of USO tours and on the cabaret circuit and in her social life, Ms. Horn has always been an outspoken advocate of civil rights. During the historic March on Washington in 1963, she addressed a crowd of demonstrators. Ms. Horn helped break down Jim Crow in entertainment during the 1940s and 50s by insisting on contracts, ensuring that blacks could not be barred from her performances in white establishments. She also refused to entertain white troops during World War II unless black soldiers were admitted also. I asked her if she considered herself a pioneer and about the state of blacks in the entertainment industry and why it was important for Lena Horn to speak up about civil rights.
It wasn't important for Lena Horn. I spoke up for myself and the three musicians or the six musicians I toured with that weren't allowed to stay where I could, or we were all not allowed to go in a swimming pool or something. It had nothing to do with anything except personal attitudes about certain things. I didn't realize that I was speaking for anybody else until, way in the late 1940s. And of course, as I said, I was raised by a very militant grandmother. I think most of us have grandmothers in our past. And she just taught me that I was human like everybody else. The economy isn't that hot, and the movies are suffering, and certainly TV is doing what's tried and true over and over again. So I would say they face certain obstacles, not to do racially, perhaps, not to do with racism, but the first choice. That is, they're not the first to be hired. My people. But I think that's due to the economy. Ethel Waters and Mamie Smith and the rest of them, there was a great black singer called Black Patty, who my father remembers, who sang, who was an opera star, and she was named after Adelina Patty, the white singer. So all those laid some groundwork too, you know. I'm a Johnny come lately.
Lena Horn has never been one to avoid controversy. In 1950, she announced her three-year-old marriage to Lenny Hayden, her white musical mentor at MGM Studios, at a time when interracial marriages were still illegal in California. Her marriage proved to be one of the most durable ones in Hollywood. It ended in 1971 with Hayden's death. Also within 18 months, Lena's son Teddy Jones died of a chronic kidney ailment, and her father Ted Horn died. Lena reveals how she was able to cope with such a devastating loss.
I have no idea. It must be the way everybody else does. You know, I wasn't unique. It just happened that they were three people that I respected terribly and loved a lot. But the man upstairs takes care of all that. You know, you grieve, but you put it to use. It's a positive thing sometimes. And every one of them had been nice to me and taught me a lot. So I was not left like the woman who sometimes doesn't want to leave the husband who abuses her because she doesn't know how to work. They taught me how to work. And so I was able to survive and take care of my responsibilities.
In the early 1950s, due to McCarthyism, her friendship with singer-activist Paul Robeson caused her to be blacklisted in television. Since then, Lena has had two specials in which she has headlined, Harry and Lena with Harry Belafonte in 1970 and Lena and Tony with Tony Bennett in 1972. She has also made numerous television guest appearances, including the TV series Sanford and Son.
Well, I love Red. We've known each other a long time, and I knew him before he was famous to the world. I knew him when he only had certain places to work in, and he was brilliant then. And I was just happy that he had been discovered, you know what I mean?
Ms. Horn's first Broadway show in which she starred was in Jamaica in 1957. She will probably be most remembered for her role in the Broadway musical The Wiz with her song Believe in Yourself. I asked Lena if she had received any film offers since The Wiz.
Oh, I have had the offer to be lots of people's mothers and grandmothers. I sort of lean toward Billy Dee Williams. I would like to have had a son. Well, he's almost as pretty as my son was. But I'm not that anxious. It would be nice, but I've been reading some, but they're mostly monkey see, monkey do, you know.
Today, the beautiful widow has divided her time between her career and her grandchildren. Miss Horn is a rather shy, private person off stage. In her spare time, she likes to curl up with a good book, spend time at her Santa Barbara, California retreat harvesting oranges, and...
Worry about my grandchildren, worry about my daughter. I love to worry. I'm a worrier.
Miss Horn's most popular recordings include Stormy Weather, Blues in the Night, The Lady is a Tramp, and Mad About the Boy. I asked Miss Horn about her favorite songs.
Oh, I hate my recordings. The only one I ever made I care anything about, really, beside the one of the show, is the one I made with Gabo Szabo. It's good. It's a good album.
Now I'm going to sing a sad song about an old broad with money. She falls in love with a young stud. Actually, she should have known better. She couldn't have been so dumb, she wouldn't have had no money. Let's say she permitted herself to get weak once in a while. That happens, you know. And let's say that this young stud was not always quite as slick as he was supposed to be. That happens sometimes too. Rarely, but it happens. After one whole quart of brandy, lackadaisy, I awake with no bromo seltzer handy. I don't even shake. Men are not a new sensation. I've done pretty well, I think. But this half pint imitation keeps me on the blink. I'm wild again, beguiled again. A simpering, whimpering child again, bewitched, bothered, and bewildered am I. Sleep where I shouldn't sleep, bewitched, bothered, and bewildered am I. I lost my heart, but what of it? It's my mistake, I agree. He can laugh, and I love it, although the laugh's on me. A pill is he, but still. to keep him until he'll be bewitched, bothered, and bewildered, just like me. Oh, I have seen a lot. I mean a lot. But now I'm like sweet 17 a lot, bewitched, bothered, and bewildered am I. Trousers that cling to him, bewitched, bothered, and bewildered am I. Oh, when he speaks, he is seeking words to get off his chest. Horizontally speaking, at his very best. I'm vexed again. I'm perplexed again. Thank God I can be oversexed again. Bewitched, bothered, and bewildered am I. First I said no, sir. Now we're two little dears. You might say we are closer than roebuck is to seals. I'm numb again. I am dumb.
Lena Horne's memoirs consist of In Person, Lena Horne, which was published in 1950, and she also co-authored Lena, another biography, in 1965. Ms. Horne's proudest achievements is receiving an honorary Doctorate of Humane Letters from Howard University and having met Eleanor Roosevelt and Mary McLeod Bethune.
Meeting Mrs. Roosevelt. You know who she was. Oh, okay. She was a good friend of a friend of my grandmother's, Mrs. Bethune. You know Mrs. Bethune. And I think that knowing those women meant a great deal to me. And I received a doctorate from Howard University, I'm very proud of, though I didn't go to school. But they took me in.
I like to think about Charlie because it was on account of him writing The Wizard I got to have this small part in the movie. It wasn't no big deal. My son-in-law was the director. Nepotism never hurt nobody. If you got it, use it. Press on with it. Remind them of it. I didn't get the part I wanted. I wanted to be the Wicked Witch of the West, Evelina, see, suits my name. But the thing is, my son-in-law said, no, Ma, see, you've been stuck with that sweet A image so long, you might as well just go on and be the good witch and forget it, you see? And 22 years between movie roles does not leave you no time to sit around, quibble, and act proud and be cute. You just take whatever they offer you, you know, do the best you can with it. I was grateful. Of course, I was happy when I made Stormy Weather and Cabin in the Sky. Then, of course, I made all those movies where I stood like this and did my thing, see? All right, now, those I'm not going to knock, because that and Stormy Weather was what made me have a career. All the black men in the Second World War wrote to Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer and said, thank you for giving us our own pin-up girl. We now can put a picture in our footlockers because a lot of places where they were, they couldn't put Betty Grable's picture in there, see? But they were safe with my picture. So I'll admit to you that the... So they made my career. And then, of course, all those pretty songs that I sang earlier in the first part of the act. When I went to Europe, places where they didn't know much about me, they knew the songs, and they were pretty and literate, and people liked them. Now, there no more than six of you out here will remember that there was once a year called 1940. Now, I don't want the other 98% of you to waste a second thinking about this time. It was a dumb year. Nothing really great happened. But this was a year that my 20% of... Well, you only one of six. Okay, hang right in there with me. This was when my 20%... Now, see, I was dumb right along with the year. I was giving this dude 20% of my $75 a week plus car fare that I was making at Cafe Society, see? He says to me, "We got to get you to Hollywood." Within your heart, you know that no one can change the path that you must go. Believe what you feel and know you're right, because the time will come around when you'll say it's yours. Believe that you can go home. Believe you can float on air. Kick your heels three times if you believe.
Late Lena Horne, entertainer, pathfinder, and civil rights activist. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions as to future In Black America programs, email us at inblackamerica@kut.org. Also, let us know what radio station you heard us over. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook and Twitter. You can hear previous programs online at kut.org. Also, you can listen to a special collection of In Black America programs at American Archive of Public Broadcasting. That's AmericanArchives.org. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station or of the University of Texas at Austin. Until we have the opportunity again for technical producer David Alvarez, I'm John L. Hansen, Jr. Thank you for joining us today. Please join us again next week.
CD copies of this program are available and may be purchased by writing In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. That's In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. This has been a production of KUT Radio. From the University of Texas at Austin, KUT Radio. This is In Black America.
We were then, like, I think Diane was 13, I was 13, Florence may have been 13 and a half. She was 6 months older than us, right? And so we actually, we rehearsed with Eddie and Paul as the primes, and for maybe a couple of weeks, it was only a couple of weeks, and pretty soon we started doing local dates at the Gold Coast Theater in Detroit, the Fox Theater, just little things. We weren't recording, and we had a guitarist who later became the Miracles guitarist, Marv Tarplin, but he was ours first. So we did all these little local record hops, right? And then we were on the show with a lot of other recording artists. So we said to ourselves, now we're 15 years old now, we said to ourselves, maybe we should try to think of recording.
The late Mary Wilson, co-founder of the legendary Supremes, died on February 8th, 2021. She was 76. With lead vocalist Diana Ross and founding member Florence Ballard, and with Ballard's replacement Sidney Birdsong, Wilson appeared on all 12 of the Supremes' number one hits from 1964 to 1969. During that period, the group charted a total of 16 top 10 pop singles, 19 top 10 R&B singles. Six of them went to the top of the chart. Like many Motown artists, Wilson, Diana Ross, and Florence Ballard grew up in Detroit and were still in their teens when they were signed in 1961 by Berry Gordy to his Young record label. In 1988, Wilson accepted the prestigious Lifetime Achievement Award on behalf of the Supremes when they were inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. In 1994, the Supremes received a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame, and in 1998, they were inducted into the Vocal Group Hall of Fame. I'm John L. Hansen, Jr., and welcome to another edition of In Black America. On this week's program, a tribute to Mary Wilson, co-founder of the Supremes, In Black America.
My world is empty without you, babe. My world is empty without you, babe. And as I go my way alone, I find it hard for me to carry on. I need your strength, I need your tender touch. I need the
What happened was, we were, when we met Eddie and Paul, I'm sorry I didn't say that, one of the other girls who was dating one of the guys, Betty McGlon, was there. So she made up the four of us that same day. We became the Primettes, and we were four. So but Betty stayed with us for like a year. I think she was a year and a half older than us. She was a little older. And she got married after that first year. And after that, we got another girl who was recommended by Melvin of the Temptations. They were Otis Williams and The Distance still. Mm-hmm. And so Melvin said, I know a girl who would fit right in with you. And her name is Barbara Martin. And so Barbara joined us. And for another year or so, we went to Motown. We auditioned at Motown, and Barbara was there for that. In fact, Barbara was on our first album, Meet the Supremes. She was on most of those songs, and she was a Supreme. She had signed as a Supreme. So there were four Supremes. People are not aware of that.
Mary Wilson was a singer, best-selling author, motivational speaker, businesswoman, former U.S. cultural ambassador, mother, and grandmother. As a founding member of the Supremes, she had a front row seat to the making of an American institution, Motown Records. Wilson died on February 8, 2021. She was 76. As the world's most famous female trio, the Supremes recorded 12 number one hits from 1964 to 1969. Growing up in Detroit Brewster Project, Wilson enjoyed a passion for singing, performing at an elementary school talent show. She met longtime friend and future groupmate Florence Ballard. In 1959, the group was too young to sign with Motown, and Berry Gordy suggested they come back when they graduated high school. 2 years later, Barry McGlon, Florence Ballard, Diana Ross, and Mary Wilson officially became the Supremes. In the spring of 2019, Wilson was on the UT Austin campus as part of the Stumbling on Race in America and the opening of the Motown 60 Years of Hitsville, USA exhibit at the LBJ Library.
Grew up in Mississippi, moved to...
You grew up in Mississippi?
Didn't you grow up in Mississippi?
No, I grew up in Detroit, Michigan.
Grew up in Detroit?
I was born.
You're born. Born in Detroit, St. Louis, Chicago. Mm-hmm. Tell us what it was like growing up in Detroit.
Well, you know, first of all, Detroit was one of those cities that people migrated from the South. My parents,
my parents,
they all, you know, so when I grew up, I was like 5 years old when I realized where I was, right? And it was great living in Detroit, Michigan, because Detroit was a great city, and it's coming back too. I've got to let you know, and everyone who's from Detroit, it's coming back. And so, you know, I grew up outside of Michigan, outside of Detroit, not in the city, in the middle there. And so it was the suburbs by the Detroit River. Mm-hmm. In which was very, very, it was a wonderful place to grow up. Then when I finally moved in with my real mom, because I was living there with my aunt and uncle, we had to move into the projects. For me, it was kind of a step down because I had grown up, you know, outside of Detroit, Michigan, and we had our own home, and my aunt and uncle had their car. They had two jobs. You know, we were, like, really well off, mm-hmm. In the 40s and the 50s. Mm-hmm. So when I had to move in with my mom, however, it was great because I met my brother and my sister and my mom, my real mom. And at first I was like, you know, I felt kind of put down because I felt adults lied to me about who I was.
Okay.
But then in the projects, in the Brewster projects in Detroit, coming there with my mom and my new brother and sister, I found something that was joyful, let's put it that way. All the people, there were lots of people. I wasn't used to all those people. Mm-hmm. And everybody was singing in the streets and they were dancing, you know, and it became not a put down for me. It was like great because now I was really being with people and I enjoyed it. That's when I met Florence and Diane and we started singing. So it was kind of like I had two kind of lives, you know. One was like kind of quiet in the suburbs and the other was loud, but it was fun in the projects.
Now, you and Florence hooked up prior to you all meeting Diane. Tell us about that relationship early on.
Well, you know, when Florence and I met, we both were in elementary school. Mm-hmm. We all lived in the Brewster Projects, and Diane lived there too with her family. However, Florence and I went to the same elementary school, and Diane was kind of went to another school, so we didn't really know her. Mm-hmm. And one day at school, they said they're going to have a little show, and anyone who wanted to, you know, sing in the show, join up. Well, I never thought I was a singer. However, I was in every choir, glee club, whatever. But I thought everybody woke up singing, so I didn't know it was a talent, is what I'm saying. Anyway, I had just seen Frankie Lyman and the Teenagers on some TV show, And so when I signed up, I said, I'm going to sing, you know, Frankie Lymon and the Teenagers song. And I pantomimed, actually, to their song, I'm Not a Juvenile Delinquent. Well, on the same show, now we're in the fifth grade. On the same show, Florence was on it, and I didn't know her either. She just lived in the projects. You know, there are thousands of people who live in the projects. So you see people, you don't know them. So anyway, she sings this song. She comes up there and she says, Ave Maria. And I'm like, whoa, she had such a huge, beautiful voice. And like, she's only 12 or 13 too. Here we are. So afterwards, she and I got together and she says, wow, you had the crowd going. You were really like, and I said, your voice is beautiful. And we said, everyone's starting these little groups. Let's you know, if anyone asks us, let's kind of remember each other. And we walked home from school. We became best friends. Next couple of weeks, Florence ran up to me and she said, these two guys, Eddie Kendricks and Paul Williams, were putting a group together, and her sister was dating their manager, and they asked her if she wanted to be in a group. And so in the meantime, someone else had asked Diana across the street. So it all kind of happened simultaneously. You know, it wasn't like weeks and weeks before we met. And so Diana said yes, and we walked over to the guy's apartment down by the Flame Show Bar, all of us, the three of us, and we talked about becoming friends on that day. And that's kind of how we got together.
How long were you all singing together prior to you all actually going to any audition?
Well, we were then, like, I think Diane was 13, I was 13, Florence may have been 13 and a half. Yeah. She was 6 months older than us, right? Mm-hmm. And so we rehearsed with Eddie and Paul as the primes, and for maybe a couple of weeks. It was only a couple of weeks. And pretty soon, we started doing local dates at the Gold Coast Theater in Detroit, the Fox Theater, just little things. We weren't recording, and we had a guitarist who later became the Miracles guitarist, Marv Tarplin. But he was ours first. So we did all these little local record hops, right? And then we were on the show with a lot of other recording artists. So we said to ourselves, now we're 15 years old now. Right. We said to ourselves, maybe we should try to think of recording. And that's when we saw the Miracles on TV, Claudette Robinson, you know, Robert, Bobby Rogers, and Pete Moore, Ron White. And so we said, you know, Diane said, I know Smokey from a former neighborhood. Maybe I can ask him, you know, if he can listen to the group. And we said, okay, good. And so we got her to call him up and do whatever, and he set up an interview at Claudette Robinson's house, and we went over there, Robinson, I should say. And the Miracles listened to us and said, oh, you guys are really good. They said, your guitars are good, too. And that's when we lost our guitars. But anyway, an audition was set up for Mr. Gordy, and that's how we eventually ended up there. But that's another long story, too. You got to read my book to know the whole story.
There was more than three, the final three, which is what was settled on. Who were the other, I think, two more prior to that before Diane, Florence, and yourself actually formed the Supremes?
What happened was when we met Eddie and Paul, I'm sorry I didn't say that, one of the other girls who was dating one of the guys, Betty McGlon, was there. So she made up the four of us that same day. We became the Primettes, and we were four. So, but Betty stayed with us for like a year. I think she was a year and a half older than us. She was a little older, and she got married after that first year. And after that, we got another girl who was recommended by Melvin of the Temptations. They were Otis Williams and The Distance still. And so Melvin said, I know a girl who would fit right in with you, and her name is Barbara Martin. And so Barbara joined us, and for another year or so, we went to Motown. We auditioned at Motown, and Barbara was there for that. In fact, Barbara was on our first album, Meet the Supremes. She was on most of those songs, and she was a Supreme. She had signed as a Supreme. So there were four Supremes. People are not aware of that.
All right, now, the Supremes were the greatest of all girl groups. Who can forget Baby Love, You Can't Hurry Love, Stop in the Name of Love, and so many more. In fact, at one point, they had 5 consecutive number one singles, rivaling the Beatles in the height of Beatlemania. Please welcome to the stage one of the founding members of the Supremes, Miss Mary Wilson. Okay, please have a seat. Well, that's a good start, wouldn't you say? Yeah. Wow.
Yes, but you know what? I didn't get a chance to sing all my background parts. I know. You know, like the oohs and the ahs, the baby, baby, babies.
That's the next panel.
But don't be laughing, because I was laughing all the way to the bank for about 55 years.
Okay. Well, there's so much to talk about, because there's so much history that Motown made and continues to make right up until today. So I want to go back in time, and I want to ask the question, because a lot of people ask this question of me as a music historian, and probably of you too. It's the 1950s, the late 1950s, and it's Detroit. And in Detroit, we have a lot of talent, obviously, because Berry Gordy, who will ultimately sign all of it and take it out of Detroit into not just America, but the entire world. My question is, was this unique to Detroit, or was it where you could go into any black neighborhood in the inner cities anywhere in America and find the same kind of talent?
You know, because in New York City, you had Frankie Lyman and the Teenagers, and they lived in the projects. So you did have talent everywhere. Yeah. But as Duke said, it was Berry Gordy with his Dare to Dream thing, and we all kind of went to Motown. So we had a place to go. So I think that's the difference. We had a place to go.
Now, the Supremes also have a backstory in terms of a name as well. You didn't start out as the Supremes, right?
No, and I actually should tell you as well that it was Eddie Kendricks and Paul Williams who became the Temptations, they were originally the Primes.
The Primes.
And so when we went to audition for them, they gave us the name of Primettes. And as Claudette was saying, back in those days, you had to say if you were a girl or a guy. And so this way everyone knew if you had an Etz or a Rail or whatever, you were a girl. And so that's how we got our name, because we were named after the Primes. Yeah. And it was amazing, because when we went to Motown to sign our first contract, and this when we started, we were only 13, 14 years old, okay? So but by the time we got to Motown, it was, I think, around 1960 or 61. So we wanted to sign our contract, and Mr. Gordy said, okay, you can sign your contract. However, you got to change that name. I don't like that name. Well, are there any lawyers out there? Okay. Here's the thing. We, at 16, we did not read our contract. Okay, we were like thrilled to be there. We would have signed. I would have given away one of my 11 grandchildren to be at Motown. Okay, that's how much we wanted to go there. We didn't care about money. We just wanted to be there. And so Mr. Gordy said to us, okay, sign the contract. And he said, did you get a new name? And we said, oh, do we really have to change our name from the Primettes? He said, oh, yeah. So Florence Ballard was almost like Claudette, was the one who pulled the name out of a bag, a brown paper bag or whatever, and it was the Supremes. Well, Diane and I and Barbara Martin, who was in the group, because we were four at the time, did not like the Supremes because it sounded like a building. You know, we're girls. We're girly girls, right? So, but Mr. Gordy said, oh, well, you got to have a new name. So Florence says, well, I call it the Supremes. So Florence was the one who named our group.
What was it like that first time you all went in the studio to record?
The first time we went into the studio, first of all, we recorded not at Motown first. We recorded at Lupine Records first. Okay. And that was a record label that was with Wilson Pickett was on it, mm-hmm. the Falcons, and, Eddie Floyd was there. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So we actually backed up a lot of those recordings with Eddie Floyd, and I think we did one with the Falcons. But we didn't really care for the company that much because we had already seen Motown. And we said, you know what? Let's get back to Motown. So we went back to Motown, and we finally recorded I Want a Guy. Mm-hmm. That was our first recording. We were I can't even say happy is the word. You know, here's what I tell a lot of people. We were three little black girls who dared to dream. at a time when dreams did not come true for black people. We really were. And I don't think we had in our minds we wanted to be stars. That wasn't what people wanted in those days. We just wanted to sing, and we found each other, and we were happy, and we knew that this was special. And so we did Dare to Dream, and when we recorded that record, I Want a Guy, it changed my life because I knew then, wow, this is something very special.
Now, you had an opportunity to attend college, but you thought about that dream.
You mean to attend our families? They allowed us to sing because it gave us something to do. We were girls, pretty, not on the street running wild, you know. So parents wanted to protect us. They said, "Oh, this seems safe, so they can do that." Right. However, when it came time to graduate from high school, they didn't. They thought we were going to go on and get a job. Right. Or go to college, college first, but get a job too. And so I remember telling Eddie Holland, I said, "Hey, if we don't get a hit record, we're going to have to go to college." He says, "Well, we're going to get a hit record." And that's when, yeah, they started really being serious about us and knowing that we were serious. And they came up with our first hit record. But it was about our eighth or ninth release, I should say that.
Tell us about that Motown experience. Obviously, it was more than just singing. It was about mannerism and young women acting like young women.
The Motown experience for us came after the fact.
Okay.
I want to first say that the three of us, you know, the four Primettes and the three Supremes, we came from families that taught us that when you walk out this door, you represent the black community. We always had the great example of being a woman, being not just a woman, but being a female who, you know, we knew what we were supposed to do in life. So blackness for us was very, very important. And so at Motown, we were very fortunate that when we walked into their door, they recognized that we were not just three girls who wanted to be singers. We really were special ladies. And it had come from our background, from our families, you know, from the church. We went to Aretha Franklin's father church, Reverend Franklin, C.L. Franklin. So, you know, we grew up around women who always dressed well. So when we walked the Motown door, they recognized that we were a little special, you know. And thank God they decided to start this artist development program. We were very fortunate to go there and have our mentor, Mrs. Maxine Powell, who taught us. She says, "I'm not an etiquette teacher now. You're finishing, you know, I teach you how, it's all inside, how to be beautiful inside." And she always said, "You beautiful people." And then she told us, "One day you're going to sing before kings and queens." Now, we're only 16 years old, okay? Right. And we're talking about, yeah, only queens I know, you know. But anyway, we eventually, yeah, we started singing before kings and queens, hanging out with them. And so, you know, it showed us that this didn't just happen. You know, to me, it was, we were chosen. We were chosen to do what we did. And I think I'm very proud of it. I spoke with Whoopi Goldberg lately. In fact, she wrote the opening to my next book, Supreme Glamour. It's all about the Supremes' gowns. And she said that when she was young and she saw us on TV and, you know, saw these three beautiful black women, it gave her something to aspire to. So, you know, it's something I'm very proud of it. You know, I don't take it lightly. If I had not been a Supreme, I would have wanted to be. But I am one.
When did you understand and realize that you all had achieved something really special?
When we achieved it? Well, first of all, it started before we became famous because we kept saying, "Well, why don't they see how great we are?" You know, because we were called the no-hit Supremes, which I wrote that, okay? I coined that phrase, but now you're saying, ooh. So you know, I coined that because, you know, we couldn't get that hit record, and that was what was going to put us over the top, right? So once we realized that's what we had to have, then our dream changed from just being singers. It changed to wanting to achieve something special. And so that was our goal. And once that happened, once Mr. Berry Gordy put us together with Harland Osher Holland, and we got the hit records, that was when we knew we had achieved it. When we were on the Dick Clark Caravan of Stars tour, and they had released Where Did Our Love Go? And the record became a hit while we were on the tour. We didn't even know it because we're on this bus tour traveling the South, you know, with people like the Drifters, the Shirelles, and Gene Pitney, and Leslie Gore. We wanted that kind of tour. So when the record became a hit and we were on this bus tour, we kind of like, you know, we knew we had made it. That's when we knew we had made, that we had achieved what we wanted to.
Tell us about that friendly competition. I assume it's friendly competition. Mary Wells, Kim Weston, Martha, Vandellas, Marvelettes.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, you say tell you about the friendly competition. I don't think that any one of us felt that we were competing against each other. And I tell you why that's so important for people to understand that. You would think with all of these wonderful talented people, there would be competition. But as you did say, it was friendly. But we didn't think of it as competition. Okay. You know, I remember just being in awe of people. We were there when Stevie Wonder came in. Mr. Gordy, Berry Gordy said, we have a little genius coming in today. And I want you girls, you Supremes, to be here when he comes in. And I'm saying to myself, what is a genius? I don't know if I've ever seen a genius before. Once Stevie came in, I'm like, that's a genius. He played every instrument there. But that's the way everyone was. So we were admired each other for the talent. Now, when one person got a hit record, then, you know, you start to say, okay, when is mine coming? That's when maybe some sort of whatever. But it was always lovingly done that you know, we did the tours. Whoever, say, if the Contours opened, whoever followed the Contours would come off the stage saying, okay, beat that. And then the next one would come off and say, beat that. But it was all really a wonderful feeling. It made everyone even better.
Co-founder of the legendary Supremes. Wilson died on February 8th, 2021. She was 76.
Thor, the Metal Avenger. You are listening to the Music of the Gods with Sean Watson on WRCT, Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Behold the Hammer!
WRCT Pittsburgh.
Support comes from Austin Water. There's a grease blob wreaking havoc in Austin, causing clogged pipes and backed up sewers. Residents can help by not pouring oil and grease in the sink, instead pouring it in a can and then in the trash. Learn more at austinwater.org.
From KUT and KUTX Studios.
Hey.
From the University of Texas at Austin, KUT Radio, this is In Black America.
I didn't know enough to write about their lives as musicians and tell people something new about these three men that everybody has heard. But what I was trying to do was write a book about their lives off the bandstand and basically say that these guys, in addition to leaving an amazing musical legacy, they helped write the soundtrack for and set the table for the civil rights revolution. As Martin Luther King recognized in a little recognized speech that he delivered in the early 1960s, he said, if it wasn't for these jazz men opening America's ears and souls to the potential of black genius, that what he did in terms of integrating schools and other things might never have happened.
Larry Tye, historian, former reporter with the Boston Globe, and author of The Jazzmen, How Duke Ellington, Louis Armstrong, and Count Basie Transformed America, published by Mariner Books. Born within a few years of one another, they overcame race exclusion and violence to become the most popular entertainers on the planet. Based on more than 250 interviews, this extensively researched book brings alive the history of Black America in the early to mid-1900s through the singular lens of the country's most gifted, engaging, and enduring African-American musicians. This story also traces the development of different styles of jazz in the city where they got their start. Kansas City for Count Basie, New York City for Duke Ellington, and New Orleans and Chicago for Louis Armstrong. I'm Johnny O'Hanson, Jr., and welcome to another edition of In Black America. On this week's program, The Jazzmen, How Duke Ellington, Louis Armstrong, and Count Basie Transform America, with author Larry Tye, In Black America.
What I think they did was, in white households where the racist head of the household would never have let a black man cross their threshold, they wooed these same racist white men, wooed their sweethearts with the music of the gravel-throated Satchmo Armstrong and with the Duke Ellington Orchestra. White women who, if they saw a black man coming towards them on a sidewalk, would have walked to the other side of the street. When they were in their own living room, they kicked off their high heels and danced to the toe-tapping music of the Count Basie Orchestra. For once, when they were listening to these three guys, race fell away as an issue, and America just wanted to listen. And people became convinced, first, of their genius, second, of their humanity, and I think that hope opened people's ears to the idea that maybe these guys actually deserved equal rights.
Larry Tye's The Jazzmen opened a new window into the lives of three iconic jazz musicians, revealing so much more about their musical journey and personal experiences off the bandstand. What is far less known about these groundbreakers is that they were bound not by just their music or even the discrimination that they, like nearly all African-American performers of their day, routinely encountered. These three titans of jazz defied and ultimately overcame racial boundaries by opening America's eyes and souls to the magnificence of their music. In the process, they wrote the soundtrack for the Civil Rights Movement. They took their songs into the white households that would not let a black man through the front door. Recently, In Black America spoke with Larry Tye.
All of you.